Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg Host for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. Right now on this historical day, we start the journey back in 1860, because it certainly has been quite an eventful day, especially in U.S. politics. 1860 on this day was the day Abraham Lincoln was elected as President of the United States. He was the 16th President of the United States. Interestingly enough, throughout history, and we'll get through some of those dates as we get through the segment, there have been seven presidents that have won the election on this particular day in history. And of those seven presidents, five of them have been Republicans. The only Democrats to break that chain were FDR in 1940, as well as Barack Obama being re-elected in 2012. But in 1913, on this day, Mahatma Gandhi would be arrested for starting the Indian Miners March in South Africa. 1918, on this day, Poland would become a republic. And in 1928, on this day, Herbert Hoover would be re-elected Republican, a president there. In 1940, it would be FDR. In 1900, it was William McKinley. He was also a Republican. In 1941, the United States would lend the Soviet Union $1 million. I wonder why. In 1956, President Eisenhower would be re-elected, another Republican. In 1962, Saudi Arabia would proclaim the abolition of slavery. In 1973, on this day, Roger Moore would begin filming The Man with the Golden Gun. In 1984, on this day, Ronald Reagan would be re-elected, winning 49 states. 1990, on this day, Whitney Houston would drop her third studio album, I'm Your Baby Tonight. We miss Whitney. In 2001, on this day, the TV show 24 would premiere on Fox Network. It is, interestingly enough, 23 years old today. And in 2018, on this day, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, would be elected to the House of Representatives as the youngest ever House of Representative elected in the United States at the age of 29. 2018, wrapping things up on this day, Idris Elba would be named by People Magazine as the sexiest man alive. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And on the show today, we are going to be reflecting on that Donald Trump victory. We're going to be taking a look at what that means for South Africa, for the world. Certainly been an interesting day on the markets, and markets have reacted to the presidential announcement there. Then we've got a conversation with the National Consumer Commission around the space that is telemarketers. It seems as though the amendments being proposed to the Consumer Protection Act could mean the end of spam calls for you and I. Hooray! And then, because it's Wednesday, we're going to do two features that we usually do on a Wednesday. We're going to do a Warning Wednesday feature with the FSCA around some debarments and enforcement actions from their perspective. And we're going to do an Executive Lounge on a Wednesday because, well, it's a Wednesday.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As always, we kick off the show with how the markets have been moving throughout the day, and today they certainly have. Joined on the line by Sasfin Wealth's David Shapiro to take a look at the market movements and see if we can make sense of anything that's happened today. Good evening, Uncle David. Lovely to speak to you, as always. Clearly, we know where Donald Trump stands on emerging markets, because their response to emerging market currencies was nothing.
It was bad. And I think the dollar improved. There are a couple of stories, Jimmy. It's not easy just to draw a straight line through what's happening today. So they're all conflicting stories. From our point of view, the dollar strengthened dramatically on concerns that rates would go up there through inflation, and also tariffs would put up inflation. That same old story. So rates went up there, the dollar improved. That took commodity prices down quite dramatically. So we had a huge reversal in commodity prices, which knocked our market. So we had big losses in platinum and gold shares and so on. It generally was a bad day from our point of view. Europe also suffered the same fate because, there are concerns about tariffs there, what tariffs increases would mean for their exporters and growth on that side. There's also concerns about you know, Trump's view that they must just pump oil and roll back on green energy initiatives. So all the renewable energy companies came under pressure. So it's all these things. The other one, if you look in the in the U.S., bank shares are going through the roof. Why? Because taxes will come down, but also he promised deregulation, you know, of banks, too much regulation. So you're getting all these movements. U.S. market's very, very strong, but it's very hard. It's, you know, it's very jumbled, very hard just to kind of catch it and give you one kind of clear, coherent statement of what's happening.
I think the clear statement, though, that has been made here is that the U.S. dollar is in favor. America will continue to do what America does for America, and Donald Trump is going to be evidence of that. I mean, when we look at the election results, hardly any surprises there. It seems as though it was a fairly one-sided race at some point in some of the states. Uncle David, what does this now mean for the... We're not done with the week. Perhaps let's start with that, right? We still have an FOMC decision coming out tomorrow. And what does this mean for Fed Chair Jerome Powell? Is he on thin ice? Is he going to be unemployed soon?
He's stoic. You know, he doesn't show any kind of expression on his face. And he will carry on talking about the U.S. economy, talking about inflation. And he will reduce rates by his 0.25% and then probably another one, because that's the path, you know, that they've decided. He's not going to – there's no evidence now of what Trump's going to do. At the moment, it's all supposition. It's all promises. He's still got to get it through Congress. You know, we still don't know what the composition of the House is. We know the Senate is going to the Republicans. We're knowing, you know, who's in the White House. So that's the one area – that remains still in the air. The issue is that if they get a clean sweep, yes, then he can push through whatever he wants. But for the meantime, I don't think he's going to be influenced by that at all, you know, by where rates are at the moment. So, you know, where the bond market is taking things, I think it's a bit of a worry for him that it has gone up to these kind of, you know, to this point, and that people are thinking that inflation is going to continue upwards because of Trump's policy. So I don't, but he's, you know, you see when he gets up, he won't have any expression. He'll just carry on as though nothing's happened. You know, there's been no change in the last.
Well, in terms of worrying, we have reason to be worried. The resources counters and resources sector in South Africa was down more than 4% at one stage today. Resources not having a good day at all. Obviously, with the confirmation that Donald Trump has returned to the White House, markets are clearly showing which side of the fence they're sitting on. And when we look at South African markets in particular, there was a massive sell-off in South African markets. Yes, resources were a big part of that, but our financial stocks were down, our industrial stocks were down. Is this signs of more to come? Is South Africa going to be in for a bit of a rougher ride now that Donald Trump is back?
I think this is just knee-jerk reaction. It lasts for a day or two and then things settle down. This is just the one day response that we knew would happen. Is it going to keep people out of emerging markets? I don't think so. What happens is once there are concerns, Jimmy, I don't want to brush it aside. There are concerns because if he does carry on with his favorite word of tariffs, you know, which I don't think is practical, and I think is probably more threatening at this stage than actually going to be imposed. But, you know, from our point of view, it will be a worry how we're going to address it. I think Europe's in more of a difficult situation because of their exports. And, you know, we've got China as well. China's not helping. If you had a counterbalance where the Chinese economy was strong, that would kind of counterbalance all of this. But we're doing this. This is all happening at a time where China is really swerving. You know, we've seen the demand, particularly for consumer demand in China, falling quite dramatically as well. So that's also impacting on Europe and, you know, to an extent in South Africa in terms of commodities. So, you know, that's the counterweight. So America, as you mentioned, as you said, in a very strong position.
Uncle David, I know you don't like looking at this, but apparently the rest of the world seems to believe that this is the right president for Bitcoin. how do we reconcile that? How do we reconcile a Trump victory with all-time highs on Bitcoin?
Well, because he's a supporter of Bitcoin. You know, from that point of view, he supports it. So he's got his cheerleaders out there, you know, who are pushing it. And I don't understand Bitcoin because I don't like to buy something that's static, you know, that only goes up because other people are buying them. I like operating businesses. That's my nature and that's how my approach. So, but you know, I can't ignore the fact that people have made a lot of money by buying Bitcoin. You know, you can't ignore it, and it'd be silly to do so. And you know, it's like scoring goals. It doesn't matter how the team won. You know, if they put the ball in the back of the net, they win the game. And I think that those people who've had the courage to go with Bitcoin and have done incredibly well, you know. But it's who knows where it's going next. Gold came down, for example, quite dramatically today. You know, fell below 2,700, continued to fall as well. But for the meantime, Bitcoin's holding it. So, yeah, good luck to those people. I hope they cash in and make lots of money and spend it.
Well, one person that certainly cashed in on the opportunity is Donald J. Trump. He's now the president again. But we'll leave the conversation there, Uncle David. Thank you so much for the time and for the insights. I look forward to the next time you're in New York to see how things look vastly different now that Donald Trump is back in power. That was David Shapiro of Sasfin Wealth on the markets update. And really, the US election's the only thing that's been moving markets.
The Property Pod.
The township and rural shopping centre subset of the property market continues to thrive with more development on the go as investors pile in. On the Property Pod this week, we speak to Smital Rambai, Portfolio Manager of the Unlisted Community Property Fund, or Comprop as it is better known. Comprop is invested in SA's township and rural retail property market.
The Property Pod. Pod.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And it has been confirmed. The 47th president of the United States is Donald J. Trump. We never thought we'd see him in the White House the first time round, but he's back for a round two. I'm joined on the line by a professor at the Gordon Institute for Business Sciences, Professor Adrian Saville, to take a look at this historical U.S. election result and see what it means for global politics as well as for global trade. Good evening, Prof. Saville. Thanks so much for taking the time. Always lovely to speak to you. When we look at this election, I, for one, expected more fireworks. I thought we'd get a bit of a closer run, somewhat of a close election. But Donald Trump not only won the electoral votes, also had the most number of votes, which is different to what it was in his first run at the White House. Your thoughts on this victory? It was a very hard, it wasn't really a very hard-fought victory. It was a very easy victory, seemingly.
Yeah, Jimmy, great to be with you. And, you know, what a day. There's that meme, you know, going around, which shows Elon Musk in the White House holding the sink, you know, saying, let this sink in. And, you know, I think that that's exactly, you know, the moment that we found ourselves is, as you point out, it's not only that Trump has got the Electoral College, he's genuinely won, you know, in terms of having achieved an outright majority. So that's the way that the United States has voted. That's who they want to lead them for, you know, all of their many different reasons. One could point to an extraordinary campaign, maybe not an extraordinary campaigner, but an extraordinary campaign. And here we find ourselves, and I think, you know, on the cusp of a very, very different landscape over the next handful of years.
Prof. Saville, when we look at the campaigns, what would you say was the stumbling block or the failure of the Democratic campaign that led to such a resounding victory for the Republicans?
You know, strategically, Jimmy, I think there was a couple of things that got in the way. The first is they let Biden go on for too long. You know, everyone knew, and he wasn't in charge of the ship, but they left him at the wheel. I think that that was a fundamental error. You know, and this is not, I'm not pinning my, you know, flag to any mast, Democrat, Republican. I'm just you know, making comments on, you know, how people have won and not won. So I think that, you know, that was a fundamental misstep on the part of the Democrats. Arguably, another was that, you know, Kamala just sort of never came out with a clear set of policies that we could easily say, this is where she's going, and this is what I could vote for. Whereas Trump, you know, whether you love his policies or hate them, you know exactly where they are, you know, starting with three words, tariffs, tariffs, tariffs. There can be no doubt in your head, you know, what he means when he says drill, drill, drill. It's not the time for renewables, it's the time for oil.
When we look at those policies and the tariffs, tariffs, tariffs narrative, what does that now mean for South Africa? I mean, there was certainly a reaction in the markets. There was the gold price has been moving. South African equity price markets have been moving. But what does this mean for South Africa's relationship with the U.S.? This is, out of the two candidates, this is probably the least preferred outcome for South Africa, given AGOA and all the other relations and conversations. Where do we go from here?
Yeah, I would agree with your sentiment, and perhaps taking a step back also from that South Africa or even Africa specific sentiment to a broader global perspective. First, you know, from you know, just thinking in terms of global asset classes, this is good for equities, especially big equities. Large U.S. companies are already responding on the day very positively to the anticipated tax cuts, the easier environment for business, especially big business. Commodities are not liking it as much because whilst this is arguably good for the United States, the onshoring, the tariff barriers and so on, it's not good for world growth, economic growth. And that then takes some wind out of the sails of commodity prices, which then becomes specifically bad for Africa and South Africa. Not only is your demand side hurt because of lower commodity prices, your supply side is going to be hurt because of higher inflation, input inflation as a result of trade obstacles.
Prof, what are some of the other expectations? Trump was very clear in his campaign trail that under his presidency, there were no wars that were started. Can we expect that the wars that have been started by the previous administration would be tackled by Donald Trump? Or can we expect a bit of more of the same in terms of global conflicts, global trade? We know the very clear policy that is without a shadow of a doubt is it will be America first. But does that mean that America will no longer be involved in the global conflicts?
There's, you know, there's a couple of aspects to this, and, you know, possibly it's easier to think of it, you know, at the level of the sort of the individual sites of conflict to try and disentangle what's an extraordinarily complex global landscape. But arguably, you know, the two that that are of most impact and on which Trump has been most vocal is Russia and Israel-Gaza. And his undertaking is to address Israel-Gaza and then even more explicitly sort out the issues in Russia-Ukraine. And we know that he's sided with Putin on this. Now, you know, that just throws open a whole set of new scenarios on what this means for foreign policy, for international policy. Ukraine gives Russia a tongue into Europe, right onto the doorstep of a broader Western Europe. And what we've got is a Europe that has been very mute, on the back foot, and, you know, hasn't prepared in any way for this type of antagonism or hostility. So it gives us a new set of foreign forces that, to my mind, paints an even more worrying scenario than we've seen in the years under Biden.
One person who certainly isn't worried about this election outcome is Elon Musk. It seems he backed the right horse from the beginning. Yeah. And one has to wonder now. One has to wonder now, Prof, is what do we then look at from the rest of the world, from a South African perspective? Is it time to sit there and say, let's focus on ourselves because we've finally got this US election out of the way. We know where we stand for the next 5 years. It's time to just get things back on track.
Yeah, so, you know, perhaps a couple of points around. You know, the first is in the immediate sense, we want to think of, you know, who are the winners and who are the losers in this. And arguably, Big Medicine is going to be much happier with Trump than Harris. Big business more broadly is going to be much happier with Trump than Harris. You know, so we could think of immediate winners and losers. We want to go to at least the second derivative and think about what this means for us. And if we apply that question to South Africa specifically, just as we're seeing some wonderful green shoots with, you know, the suspension of load shedding, rate cutting, tame inflation, you know, here comes another set of negatives. I don't think that they're dramatic negatives. I wouldn't want to overstate that in any form. But they are negative rather than positive for South Africa. I've already made the point about commodity prices, the pressure that might brought to bear through supply chain inflation. But, you know, this, to my mind, what this really drives home is the importance for countries, policymakers, and business to get on with their business. You know, and that's not a nationalist sentiment, but there is so much that is outside of our control. Let's worry about what's inside of our control, and let's get on with the business of making that, you know, excellent, fixing the broken parts. South Africa's got enough problems before we start worrying about what's happening to us caused by the rest of the world. Let's just fix our own stuff first.
Get our own house in order, because the US has gotten theirs in order and it's time to keep things moving. Thank you so much, Prof, for the time and for the insights. I really appreciate it. That was Professor Adrian Saville of the Gordon Institute of Business Sciences joining me to reflect on the election outcome and the resounding victory for Donald J. Trump.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's a Wednesday. You know what I love to do on a Wednesday? That's some consumer awareness work. We're going to be looking at some more warnings. It's Warning Wednesdays with our friends at the FSCA. And as usual, I'm joined on the line by the Divisional Head of Enforcement at the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, Gerard van Deventer, to take a look at some of the developments from the FSCA's perspective and some things you need to be aware of as a consumer. Good evening, Gerard. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with some enforcement matters from the FSCA's perspective. Some big enforcement wins and announcements coming out this week, some fines and some debarments. Take me through those.
Yeah, thank you, Jimmy, and good evening. Always a pleasure to speak to you, and good evening to the listeners. Yeah, so I think the best place to start is the NEFG case. This has been an investigation that's been a long time coming, a tremendous big job. So we are very, very happy that it is over at last. Of course, there are still loose ends that needs to be tied up, but we have finalized our investigation report and we have finalized the exhausting enforcement process through that. So you would have seen that as far as the two kingpins are concerned, that is Cornelius Jansen van Rensburg and then that Frederick Young de Pria, those two gentlemen, they got a 30 million rand fine each. And 30 years debarment out of the industry, and which is the point you made. That is an important point. And then there's a further administrative penalty on Stein Jansen van Rensburg of 8 million rand and a debarment period of 20 years. And then lastly, Christian Jansen van Rensburg debarred for 10 years. So a lot of debarments there, and I'm happy to speak a little bit about the debarments. But on this case, I should also mention, and this is how we look at these big cases, Jimmy. Not every case deserves this, but in these big cases, you know, they certainly belong in the criminal courts as well. So no exception here. The FECA will definitely support the criminal authorities. We are actively assisting the National Prosecuting Authority. And not only did we open a case, but also a fair amount of the investors has also opened cases. And we behind that, needless to say, you know, our friends at the MPA. The interesting thing about this case, Jimmy, why we are quite harsh on them is not just the fact that they acted contra mandate. In other words, that they took clients' funds that was earmarked for a low-risk investment, and they put it into something completely different. The problem also is that completely different investment that they put it in, they had an interest. Some of them had an interest in those entities. And that for the FSCA is a really big issue. We expect our financial advisors to always advise and act without any conflict. But that message didn't seem to go all the way through. So if there's conflict of interest, you can expect that we will take a material action. It's already old news, but of the licensing part. But of course, the licenses were withdrawn of NEFG administrators in December 2021 already, and we informed the public of it at that stage, and of NEFG fund managers and the wealth strategist more recently. So those licenses are gone. They can't do business again. And of course, the individuals being debarred can't do business. I'll maybe just quickly mention the Lahumo Securities one, and then we can talk about debarments if you like.
Yes. On the Lahumo Securities one, that announcement went out as well. We spoke about it previously when the license was provisionally withdrawn. Now there's been finalized enforcement actions. Take us through those.
Sure. Yeah. So also been a case that's been longstanding. It started off some time ago, and it started off as a case where clients' funds were pooled, and we said, well, that's something that's fixable. If the clients traded and there was no dishonesty or anything like, but the clients' funds were pooled, and as a result, some clients could not get their money out, then we can fix it and we can look at regularizing the business because you don't just want to close down businesses because you can. You need to take the economy into account as well. So it started off with a directive to the owner of the business, Mr. Lentswane, with a directive to say, find money and pay those clients out that you owe, and then we can take the matter further. And first thing I need to say is he did. He actually complied with the directive. And that was quite a mitigating factor for the FSCA in making its decisions. However, unfortunately, as the investigation proceeded, because my investigators are of that kind, very suspicious people. They never take your word for anything, so they kept on investigating. As it unfolded, we realized there is a bigger issue here, and clients' funds were used to trade and so forth. And as a result of that, it now ended up as the license being withdrawn finally, and of course, a 12-year debarment of Mr. Lentswane. We brought it down from 15 years because at the end of the day, clients were paid back. So if we ignore the time value of money, Jimmy, then the clients did get their money back. Then they didn't lose anything. But of course, you can't ignore the time value of money. What's interesting about this case, it is also something that you and I have spoken about before, and that is that you must have a good look at what this individual you're working with is licensed for. Now, in this case, it was a Category 1 license. And as you know, because you're a bit of an expert on the in the area, that means you can do intermediary services and so forth, and you can advise. But Lentswane actually made investment or trading decisions on behalf of the client. Now, that, as you know, is discretionary business. And for that, you need a different license, which is a bit more difficult to get. And that is part of the problem, is you must stick within your license, stay in your lane. You can't now start doing discretionary business if you have a Cat 1 license, because that requires a Category 2 license. So those are the two big cases that we brought to fruition, landed those planes. I'm very lucky to happy to say, before Christmas came.
Just in time for the festive season.
Oh, you sound like Pick and Pay now, putting Christmas stuff out already.
Gerard, I want to look at the implications that this then has. We often speak about debarments, and we get into that and we say this person is no longer able to operate within the financial services space for a certain period of time and all of that. But let's look at the seriousness of these debarment enforcement actions, because more often than not, individuals have other businesses that they might work with, or other businesses might come in and say, I want to do business with Jimmy, not knowing that Jimmy has been debarred by the FSCA. How do we navigate that conversation, and what do businesses and people need to know about dealing with an individual who's been debarred?
Oh, that's a very good question, Jimmy. I'm really grateful that you give me the opportunity to speak about that. So a debarment, firstly, the thing about a debarment is you don't have to be a financial services provider to be debarred. In terms of our new legislation, we also debar people who has not been a financial services provider. So in those instances, what we really say is we don't want you coming into the industry, although you haven't been in the industry lawfully. So that's the one thing. But a debarment basically means that you are not allowed to be involved in financial services at all. So basically, you cannot work in the financial services industry. There's no guarantee that somebody is not going to work from behind the scenes, but the management team that allows that puts themselves at risk. They put their licenses at risk, and they put their own, they raise the possibility of their own debarment as well. So you out of the industry, and this is not a penalty. You know, this is not, we're not punishing those people. We are saying to those people, we will not allow you to be involved in the public's funds. We cannot expose the public to you. So it's a protection of the public mechanism, just like the withdrawal of the licenses. And that's why, you know, it doesn't always mean that a penalty and a debarment should line up or not. But your question, the important part of your question is really, how would the industry or the public know to deal or not to deal with these people? So we keep a list of debarred persons on our website, and we keep a list of approved persons, of licensed persons on our website. So it's always a good idea for businesses to check whether there's been a debarment. A simple Google search or a search on our website will show you that. But of course, public is always welcome to phone. And the other thing I think it's fair to say, Jimmy, is that we don't debar for silly contraventions. Debarments come in when there's an element of dishonesty or material misconduct. We're not going to take away a person's livelihood because there's some fixable contravention, some oversight, some systems failure. That's not how it works. It is reserved for those people where we're looking at material dishonesty. And you won't be able to work in a financial services industry or a financial institution. But of course, you are welcome to engage in any other business. But any business that does their due diligence should come across this. And then those businesses must make up their minds. What are the type of people they want to employ?
The only thing we can do is protect the public as best as we can. Gerard, before we wrap things up, I want to take a look at the latest round of warnings. It seems the pattern still continues. Unrealistic returns being promised to South Africans. How do we get the message home? Unrealistic returns are not possible.
I don't know, Jimmy. I've said this so many times. You have said it so many times. And we've spoken about, is it greed or is it desperation? And I just don't know anymore. But you're right. Those two examples, FX Nonstop and Tiger Agriculture, are sterling examples of unrealistic returns. And as you and I discussed before, if I have the recipe to make this much money in a week, I mean, in the case of FX Nonstop, 40% per week, I can go on early retirement, although my retirement is not that far away. But, I mean, you know, how would we say to the people, how many times can we say to the people, that is not possible and I would not give away my secret if I had that secret? But there's also a second interesting thing in the FX Nonstop warning that I don't know if we've spoken about it before. But that's another big issue and another huge red flag apart from unrealistic returns. And that is your investment is guaranteed and your return is guaranteed. It's such an important message to get out to say that's not possible. Your investment cannot be guaranteed and your return can certainly not be guaranteed. That guarantee is only as strong as the person guaranteeing it. And if that person is running a scam, good luck. But I think the moment no FSP with a license or financial institution with a license will make a statement like that because they will put themselves in the firing line. So unrealistic returns and guaranteed returns and guaranteed capital, huge red flag, no doubt.
Learn to spot the red flags, folks. We can't keep doing this. If you're going to keep falling for the same tricks, we'll leave it at that. Gerard, thank you so much for the time and for the insights as always. That's Gerard van Deventer, who is the Divisional Head of Enforcement at the FSCA, joining us to take a look at Warning Wednesdays and some of the enforcement matters by the FSCA.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, for something involving both public and private sectors, business and governments are coming together to build South Africa. Just take a listen to how this is happening.
My name's Craig Miller. I'm the CEO of Anglo-American Platinum, and I'm here supporting the pledge with the presidency and Business for South Africa. I am absolutely committed and excited about what the pledge represents for as is business in partnership with government and broader South African society. I'm really excited about the opportunity that the pledge creates. Not only does it create economic growth, but jobs and sustainable jobs, which is fundamentally important for us as South Africans, but importantly for me as a company and the company that I represent. So very entrenched in South Africa in the mining industry. And so that's really where the benefit comes in terms of for us as a company, as Anglo-American Platinum, and therefore what we're able to contribute to South Africa. Some of the benefits that we've started to see from an energy supply perspective, working collaboratively as one in terms of addressing the crisis that we faced. And I think that's really, really important.
To learn more about this impactful commitment to South Africa's future, visit business4sa.org. That's business4sa, as in the word for, .org. We got some really good news today out of the Department of Trade, Industry and International Cooperation. Well, potentially good news. There are some revisions or amendments that could be coming through to the Consumer Protection Act by way of adjustments for telemarketers. We can finally put this to bed. We can finally get rid of spam calls. I'm joined on the line by the Deputy Commissioner at the National Consumer Commission, Tezi Mabuza, to take a look at this and try and make sense of these developments and what we can from there. Good evening, Member Buza. Thanks so much for taking the time. Can we start by understanding the amended regulations that have been put forward? What are the amendments that have been proposed?
For the opportunity, the amendments, as we're saying, really they are the amendments. They want to put in place the mechanisms on which now consumers can opt out. Now, what happens is that we have the regulation, we have the section in the Consumer Protection Act that allows any other consumer to preempt that they will be called by a marketer to market to them. But then the section by itself does actually lend itself to some regulations. But before those regulations could be amended, could be implemented, the minister then is empowered now to put in place the mechanisms for which this registry that allows you to opt out then can be then put into force. The act is that now, as the National Consumer Commission, we can either recognize an existing registry or we can develop our own. In this case, the NCC decided to develop its own as the regulator so that it can deal with the complaints that consumers are complaining about. But what it does as well is that it puts an obligation on the direct marketer that before they run any other campaign, they have to consult the registry and determine that the people that they have that have opted in on their side have not opted out. They still interested in them contacting them. Then that would mean that before they just call you with a register, check, no, Tezi Mabuza said this number belongs to Tezi, she doesn't want to be contacted, then they cannot contact her. So that is that amendment.
That's quite an interesting point there as well. I think you've just touched on about the fact that now the onus is no longer on consumers. It's on the marketing side of it to verify that they are allowed to then come and market to us. From a consumer point of view, what does that then mean for what our kind of protections are in terms of if I'm on this registry, Jimmy is on the registry, Tezzy's on the registry, but we still get phoned or called by these telemarketers in an intrusive manner. What do we then have as our protections, and what do the companies themselves stand to be liable for?
Yes, it won't be then an infringement of the Consumer Protection Act, but it's an infringement on my privacy because I do not want to be called for direct marketing. Now, in this case, what we like about this regulation is that there is no gray area. It's actually you called and the person is in the registry, you should not have called. So what you would be doing now, the mechanism of the registry is that you will tell us, Tezzy will send us a complaint that says, I've been called by this number. And voila, there it is. You will also say, I've been called by this number. And then the nice thing about the registry is that we'll be now looking at this number, working with other regulators and other service providers to say, belongs to you. And then in terms of our analysis, it called, let's say, 1,000 people. Then based on that, then we will be then looking at the provisions of the Act that now looks at an administrative fine in this case to say that you violated the CPA, and then let us look at your 1 million of your annual and over, because here there's no gray or white. You know, there's no gray. It's either it's black or it's white. So that is how easy it should be. So in this case, there is no need for you now to say, I am opting out. Because for us, you opt out once. In the registry, you will be opting out once. And then from there, and after a month, no one will be able to call you. If they call you, it will be the violation of the CPA.
Mm. I want to look at the call centers. The call centers where these calls originate from. More often than not, Jimmy runs a business. He's got a call center agency. He hires a bunch of call center agents to make these particular calls. Now that this is going to be changing, do I, as the call center owner, have an obligation to, number one, educate my staff on what they can and can't do? And number two, is it my responsibility as the owner of the call center to then make sure that this information is given to them so that they themselves also know what they can and can't do?
That is a very good question, Jim, because what is interesting is when you run a business, you know what laws you should not be violating. The first one is around the issue of your POPIA. You have people's information that you should be guarding. So the people, even as the Consumer Protection Act, in terms of as a commission, we also have to do that. So that's the first area, is that that information is sacrosanct. You have to only use it for that purpose. That's the first thing. But then the obligation is on you. You have to be teaching your staff how to use that information, and because is to market. Before you even run a campaign, the one thing that you should be doing would be asking every marketer, that's what registry will be doing, every marketer will have a responsible person that would then say, we are running this campaign. Before we even start calling now, let us now cleanse our list. Let us check that from the 1 million people that we have, no one of them have opted out. It's their obligation. Because now, remember, even the young that calls you from the contact center, he will be like saying, I'm calling you because I received your number from this details. You know, they will be giving you some background story. So that background story would be, I'm calling you because you have allowed us, you have given us permission to call you. So that is that obligation of every marketer. And the person responsible makes that list is clean.
When we say every marketer, does that now mean regardless of the service and what you are marketing? So whether I'm marketing a new cell phone contract, or whether I'm marketing a debt review program, or whether I'm marketing an international service or whatever, every marketing service that operates in South Africa would be subject to these new amendments?
Precisely. Marketing, it doesn't matter whether you are marketing a vehicle or an insurance. In this case, what we are talking about marketing as a service, not the commodity. Because sometimes you would know that there will be other services that will fall under the financial services regulator as well. So that will be in their purview in terms of the product. But then when you offer to sell and say, Tezi, I am calling you because I think you are interested in this. That is that service that we will be regulating to ensure that every person that you are calling should be the person that has allowed you to call them.
There is no gray area here. It is very black and white, and the legislation will go through to protect consumers. You have to love it, because this is the hard work that goes into the work that the NCC and the DTIC do. Thank you so much, Deputy Commissioner. We'll leave it at that. That's Deputy Commissioner of the National Consumer Commission, Tezi Mabuza, joining me to take a look at the latest amendments to the Consumer Protection Act aimed at protecting consumers from intrusive marketing calls.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's Wednesday, it's executive lounge time, and it's time to get to know another South African executive a little bit better. This week we're joined on the line by the Manufacturing and Supply Chain Director for Sub-Saharan Africa at Mondelez International, Anna-Marie Viljoen, to get a bit of an idea of what she gets up to on a day-to-day basis and what she gets up to when she's not supplying the world with all the chocolates that we know and love. Good evening, Anna-Marie. Thanks so much for taking the time. What does a manufacturing and supply chain director do at such a big organization?
Hi, Jimmy. Yes. Well, we look after the full production of the product, then supply it to the customer, and then also responsible for all the buy-in of all the materials and the ingredients in order to actually produce the product. So it covers mainly your manufacturing, it covers your planning, it covers your supply chain and logistics areas, it covers engineering, also looking after all the equipment that we require and for the production of the product. So in a nutshell, that's what we do.
Sounds like you're busy every single day, all day. Is there a particular area of the business that you enjoy the most?
Yes, the people. The people I enjoy the most. I think, and that's also the reason why I am in manufacturing or in supply chain. It is a very resource intensive function or area of the business, and you actually work with people that is on all levels in the company in that specific function, and I think for me that's what's really making me happy every day to get up and go to work, is that I can see how important the people are and what small things that we do as management and leadership, how that actually positively influences the people.
Mm. Anna-Marie, before you joined the team at Mondelez and the FMCG space, you kind of worked in various sectors, including the public sector, banking, automotive. Would you say you are happiest in this current sector, or was there a particular sector you worked in the past that you say that you'd think if you could go back, you might go back and visit there?
Jimmy, I think if I look at my career, I found joy in each industry. So you find the best things in that industry that actually makes you want to work in that industry. When you move on to the next industry, you find something else that is really unique to that industry. I think if I look at FMCG, yes, FMCG is definitely one of my favorites. But when I started my career, IT was one of my favorites. So it depends on what you do with your job and your industry and how you actually cope within that industry. So I can't say that I have one favorite one, but if I have to choose, I will definitely choose FMCG and the motor industry.
Very interesting indeed. Anna-Marie, let's move away from work. Let's look at some of the fun stuff. What do you enjoy doing when you are not at work and not helping businesses grow?
I think for me, my family is the most important. Spending time with them, and we actually spend quite a lot of time. We are privileged that my stepchildren and their families are all very close, living very close to me, really spending a lot of time with them and the grandchildren. Then I love reading. I read a lot, but also doing audio books. So, and I try every year, once a year, to go skiing in Europe. And then I also have two dogs, which is very important for me. They like my de-stresses. And I think without dogs in my life, it will be very difficult to cope.
Anna-Marie, let's be honest. Do you have a favorite grandchild?
I can say yes, but I can't tell you who it is.
That's okay. I just wanted to know. For years, I've always debated and wondered whether or not, as a grandparent, you end up having favorites in life. And it's good to know that you have a favorite grandchild. It's unfortunate for that grandchild that they won't know who it is. But I suppose it's always good that all of them think they're the favorite.
Yes.
It always makes them feel better. What's your favorite destination that you've traveled to?
Definitely Europe. We love Munich. Because I was in the motor industry, it was like my second home. So we go there quite often. But then all over Europe. We really traveled all over Europe. And I would say all the ski resorts in Europe is my favorite.
Anna-Marie, if you could share one piece of advice with your grandchildren, with your children, with anyone that you've worked with, what would the piece of advice be that stuck with you?
I think I, very early in my life, I came to the realization that, you know, it doesn't matter what you do, just as long as you're happy. So for me, everything that I did and all the decisions that I've made was around me and my family being happy. And I think that helped me in quite a lot of my decision makings, where it sometimes was difficult to make the decisions. For example, when they asked me to go overseas and work in projects overseas, my first question was, am I going to be happy? Is my children going to be happy? Is my family going to be happy? And if the answer was no, I would say no, then I won't go. And I think that is extremely important, because for me, you only live once, and you must be making your life as happy as possible for you, because you only have one life.
That's very true. You only have one life. Anna-Marie, what's your favorite meal?
My favorite meal, it is, I would say it's like a nice plate of prawns.
Okay. That's not something you'd find in Munich. I suppose you'd find it anywhere in the world. But it does come with its benefits. Would you have a preferred beverage, whether it's hot or cold? What's that one thing that you can't look, that you can't wait to pour a glass of at the end of the day, or a cup of?
Nice glass of white dry wine.
Why dry specifically?
I think the sweeter wines, number one, you pick up weight quite a lot when you drink that. And then it's also, you know, you can only have so much of that, and then it becomes too sweet. So the dry white wine is really, I can have like one or two glasses of that. And if it's ice cold with some ice in it, really enjoyable.
That's a very specific taste, and there's nothing wrong with that at all. Anna-Marie, you attended the Swiss Business School, amongst all of the other educational qualifications that you hold. How is the international kind of educational landscape different from what we have here in South Africa? And what do you think we could be doing to improve the quality of what we have here?
Okay, so just to put it in perspective, when I went to the business school, it was many years ago, and I'm sure there has lots of changes that has happened. But I can tell you, at that stage, the quality of the education was not much different between what we had in the Swiss business school as well as in South Africa. So to be honest with you, I cannot tell you how it is now. I'm talking from my experience. I had the experience very similar in a local university than the Swiss Business School.
Mm. Anna-Marie, you mentioned that you like reading. What are you currently reading?
Oh, I only read fiction. You know, no heavy stuff. I don't read heavy stuff. When I read, I relax. I don't want to learn, so I read fiction. And most of the fiction I read is like detective stories.
Okay.
No, so nothing deep in that. No biographies, no deep leadership books or anything. It's only fiction.
I suppose we all need to find a way to de-stress, especially when the workload or the work day can sometimes be so long. Anna-Marie, what's the one destination in the world, other than Munich, that you would go back to if you could travel again?
You know, I think this is a difficult question.
It's because I took Munich off the table.
I think I would go back to the States. I've been in there, but only in certain areas. But I really would like to go back to the States and actually experience a lot more of the United States than what I had.
Well, Donald Trump has returned as president of the White House. I suppose now's as good a time as any to go visit the United States. Anna-Marie, as a Mondelez executive, this is the second most important question of which of your grandkids is your favorite, is which of the Mondelez products is your favorite?
Chappies.
Oh, okay. Simple, straightforward, to the point. Consistent product, by the way. It's been around for years.
Yes. And I grew up with Chappies, and that's why it's still my favorite.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you so much, Anna-Marie, for the time and for the insights. It's been lovely getting to know you a little bit better. That's Anna-Marie Viljoen, who is the Manufacturing and Supply Chain Director for Sub-Saharan Africa at Mondelez International.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And that's the show for today, folks. Thanks for tuning in. If you've missed any of the conversations, they are going to be put up online. You can catch up on them. It's coming up to 7 o'clock. Greg Host is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson with the sports update. From my side, good night.